Welcome to the Voices of Women Physicians podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Tatiana Resnik, a practicing physician and a certified life coach. You will hear about inspirational journeys and practical tips from amazing women physician experts, as well as effective coaching and steps in your mindset. Welcome, everyone. This is the second part of our interview with Dr. Anisha Bhopal. And we're going to talk again about interesting topic, sleep. All of us need sleep, and patients ask us about health with sleep all the time. So listen to this interview. Welcome, Dr. Bhopal. Please tell us a little more again about you for those listeners who didn't have the chance to listen to last week's episode yet.
Thank you so much for having me back on. So I'm Dr. Anisha Bhopal, a physician specializing in integrative psychiatry and sleep medicine. I have a private practice in California. It's called Pacific Integrative Psychiatry, and we help patients with a whole body approach to mental health and sleep issues. And then I've got an online platform called IntraBalance, where I teach physicians, therapists, and healthcare practitioners all about integrative clinical sleep medicine, because most doctors only get about 2 hours of sleep medicine education training, but all of our patients have to sleep. So I just love talking all things sleep education. So you can find me on YouTube for more information about that.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming back. So let's talk about sleep. Many of us hear from patients request for medications which can help with sleep. And especially I, as a hospitalist, frequently hear from elderly hospitalized patients about their difficulty sleeping and noise and being in a hospital, making it even extra difficult. And they want a sleeping pill. So what is a safe and helpful approach to it?
It's such a great question because it's a really tricky situation to manage, right? Because behaviorally, it's very difficult to modulate the environment that they're sleeping in, right? Because for outpatients, we would really focus on behavioral strategies and then modulating light and dark exposure. But in a hospital setting, it's hard to do that. It has been shown that things like reducing interruptions during the night, reducing noise around the sleeping environment, keeping it dark in the evening and then bright during the day, these things can help for inpatients in the hospital. But we have to be careful too with regard to if you're using medications, like you said, things that are excessively sedating or that could cause delirium. So it can be really tricky. So there is evidence around these sort of behavioral measures that I was talking about, but sometimes you do have to use medication if the patient really isn't sleeping. So a few things that I would recommend. One is also making sure that you are addressing any pre-existing sleep conditions when the patient's in the hospital before you're prescribing them anything. So for example, obstructive sleep apnea, super common, right? So you want to make sure that the patient is able to use their CPAP or BiPAP machine at night. And so making sure that that is being treated. And again, you don't want any risk of respiratory depression if you're going to be prescribing sedatives. So making sure that that's treated. The other thing too is we talked about restless leg syndrome in the first episode. So making sure they don't have something like that. And if they're on medication for that, making sure that that is also being treated. Now, having said all that, let's say you've done the behavioral interventions to the extent that you can, you've looked at these underlying causes, then yes, there may be a role for medication. So there are studies showing that intermediate acting benzodiazepines like lorazepam or temazepam can be useful first line. But again, you have to be so careful if it's an elderly patient who has other comorbidities. So it's also been suggested that trazodone could be an alternative to those medications as well. The idea here is that we're not going to be sending patients home with those things, but you really just want to be helping them to get sleep while they're in the inpatient setting. But it's such a difficult thing because you also take into account all their other comorbidities. But I would start with the behavioral strategies, then looking at the other underlying causes, making sure those are treated, and then medications are like a last resort to go to.
What do you think about melatonin in this setting?
So there hasn't really been shown any benefit for melatonin in the inpatient setting. As far as I know, I'd have to go back and look at the research on that. If the person's already taking melatonin, then that could be helpful. You can continue that. And like we talked about in the first episode, actually, there's a lot of research on melatonin having its anti-inflammatory effects. So there may be benefits aside from sleep that could be helpful for the patient. But really what melatonin is doing is we're trying to regulate the circadian rhythm with melatonin. It's not really a sedative or a sleep aid. It's more of a body clock regulator. So it works really well in conjunction with all of those other behavioral regulators, particularly light and dark exposure, and then regular meal times and activity.
And how to handle if your patient insists on taking sleeping pills, inpatient or outpatient? It's quite common.
Yeah, absolutely. So with this one, it's really a conversation, right? So this is where using your bedside manner, your clinical skills, if you have some training in cognitive behavioral therapy, using those, your therapy skills can come into play. So there's a few things here. So I like this model called the Fife model. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. Sometimes they teach it in medical schools, and it's a patient-centered interviewing model that anyone can use. So it's FIFE, and it stands for feelings, ideas, functioning, and expectations. And you can do this really quickly with any patient. And if you use this tool with patients, oftentimes you'll hear something like, oh my gosh, you're the best doctor I've ever seen. No one has ever listened to me like that before. And really all it is, it's exploring their feelings. What are your feelings about what's going on? What are your fears about what's going on with regard to your sleep? Exploring their ideas. What do you think is going on? Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think you're having sleep issues? So F is for functioning. So how is this affecting your functioning? Tell me about your day to day. What impact is this having on you? And then E is for expectations. What are your expectations about what sleeping pills can do for you? How do you think they're going to work? How's your life going to be different with them and without them? So starting with that will give you more information about where the patient is coming from and what's really important to them, because sometimes what we think is important isn't what's important to them, right? So we want to make sure there's alignment on that so we can create a collaborative treatment plan. Then I do discuss the risks with patients. So the risks of sleeping pills. So I let them know that these were never designed for long-term use. They're only designed for short-term support, for acute support. They're not designed for chronic use. And chronically, they can start to cause more issues down the line. So things like tolerance, rebound insomnia, dependence can happen. And so they can actually start to cause the very issue that you were trying to treat in the first place. So setting that expectation to patients and then letting them know that oftentimes when people are able to get off of these medications, they feel better and their sleep improves. So these aren't a panacea. Now, having said all of that, sometimes there is a role for medication. And so when I am prescribing a medication for a patient for sleep, I also have a conversation with them about how long this is going to be for, right? So this is short term. We'll do it for no more than 2 weeks. Usually even then, it's just like intermittently PRN as needed for maybe a couple nights at a time, while we really dig into some behavioral strategies, circadian regulation. We talked a little bit about time in bed restriction and stimulus control in the first episode. So we work on those things. And then I might also refer them for CBTI or cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is the first line gold standard treatment. So it takes time, right? But it is a conversation. And what I have found is that for patients, when you take that time to sit down with them and have this conversation, which doesn't have to be very long, like you can have this whole dialogue in a few minutes, they really seem to appreciate it, right? That like, oh, wow, you're really working with me on this. You're really partnering with me on this. And I find that that's easier, even just for you as a practitioner, than just pushing back and saying, no, I don't think Ambien's a good idea for you. Now, I know that's not how most of us operate, but the patient might receive it that way. So just using this Fife model can be really helpful.
This is really good. And not only for sleep, for many conditions, this approach is helpful. And now let's switch gears and talk about physicians, nurses, and all other professionals who work shifts. Like if you, for example, ER physician, and today you work day shift, tomorrow you work swing, and then next day you work night shift, and then again day, and you switch back and forwards all the time. Or if you like night shift nurse or any other professional. So how can you decrease the negative impact of sleep disturbance and constantly switching between night and day? What strategies could help?
Such an important topic. It was interesting when I was in residency, they were doing some research. I'll have to look back and see what the updates are on this research now, but they were doing research on people who worked night shifts. And they found that there's people who readily adapted to shift work schedules. There's people who readily adapted and their body clock was a little bit more malleable in terms of when their melatonin secretion was able to shift and whatnot. And then there was a cohort of people who hormonally just didn't adjust, right? And the people in that cohort tended to really struggle with shift work. And I put myself into that category. I really struggled with shifts during residency and fellowship. So I knew I wasn't able to maintain that kind of a lifestyle. So that's the first thing I recommend people to just reflect on. How is this impacting you? And is this something that you feel like you're pretty adjustable to it? And do you feel like you can function well? Or is it really taking a toll on your health? So starting there and just noticing. And I've even had patients where they come to me, and usually they're nurses working in healthcare and they're doing swing shifts or night shifts. And they're just like, I can't do this anymore. This is taking a toll on my health, on my life, my relationships. And so we would look at supporting them through making a change. So that's number one. But for people who are not able to make the change, because I know that's not available to everybody, or who like their job and they want to keep doing it and they want to optimize. So a few things there. So one is really making sleep a priority, right? Because sometimes the temptation is like, okay, now I'm off work and I have all these hours free. I fill it up with activity. Let me go do the laundry. I'm going to go grocery shopping, do all these things. So just remembering that you still need to sleep to function. So making that a priority. Using caffeine strategically can be helpful in some cases. So actually Dr. Allison Cole on my YouTube channel, she talked about her. She did this, her caffeine strategies when she was working shifts. So she was doing little boluses of caffeine, just so small sips of caffeine every hour throughout her shift to keep her going and then stopping it about an hour before her shift ended.
It's good strategy.
Yeah, so that was a strategy she was using. Then the other thing is when you're leaving work, you want to wear dark glasses. So if you're leaving in the morning, you want to wear dark glasses so that you're minimizing any light exposure as soon as you finish work and by the time you get home, and then keeping the environment dark in your home so that it's more conducive to sleep. The other tip is that you don't necessarily need to have the expectation that as soon as you get off your work shift that you're going to go home and fall asleep right away. Because if you're working a day shift, right, you don't get off work and then go home and just go straight to sleep. If there's a transition period. So building in a little bit of transition period as well so you can wind down before you sleep. And then sleeping in chunks, because sometimes you're not able to get a whole 7 or 8 hour period of sleep all at once, especially if it's during the day and there's activity happening in your house and whatnot. So maybe thinking about dividing that into 3 hour blocks. Then the CDC actually has a really great resource on their website. I'll see if I can get you the link if you want to put that in the show.
Yes, I would love to.
Yeah, it's a shift work course. It's free. It's actually designed for nurses and it has strategies on managing shift work, but it applies to anyone. So any healthcare practitioner, anyone who's doing shifts, that's a good resource. And then, so one of the other last things I'll mention is if you have control over your schedule, like if you can choose what shifts you're working, then trying to keep those consistent so that you're not going wildly back and forth between early mornings and late nights. So if you can have a more consistent night shift schedule over the course of a week, so it's not like really crazy up and down hours, or if you can rotate it so that it's getting slightly later each day, that is shown to be more easy to adjust to than shifts that are just all over the place.
Makes sense. How about melatonin in this scenario? Is it a good idea or better not to?
Yeah, so there is a role for melatonin in shift work, but again, it has to be timed correctly. With melatonin, timing is really key. So it's a little bit more tricky if the shifts are all over the place versus those more consistent, like if you're just doing night shifts on a consistent schedule. So yeah, you just have to be really careful with the timing strategies on that.
Yeah, like if, for example, nocturnist doing like 1 week or like 5 days of night, so you take like 1 hour before you plan to sleep, right?
Yeah, you can take it an hour before, yes.
And similar scenario is about travel. Summer is coming, many people go travel far away, different time zones, sometimes opposite time zones. And what helps to decrease the negative impact of changing time zones and to quickly snap back into routine?
Yeah, definitely. So travel is a fun one. And so there's a couple of things that I think about. There's the time zone change that affects travel. And then there's also travel fatigue, right? So there's just the normal fatigue you get with sitting on a plane for a long time or sitting on a long car ride or whatever it is. And so there's just the fatigue that comes with that. So that you can address by just making sure you're hydrated, making sure you're not terribly sleep deprived leading up to your trip, minimizing alcohol use during travel, right? Those kinds of things, making sure that you're comfortable on your trip, that you're wearing comfortable clothes, and maybe you have your neck pillow and blanket and things like that. So trying to rest as much as you can to minimize that travel fatigue. Then as far as the actual time zone change, you can use melatonin strategically leading up to travel and during your trip. And again, it depends on where you're traveling to. So if you're going east versus west. So you can actually start adjusting. If you have the opportunity to do this, you can start adjusting your sleep schedule before you go on your trip. There is an app called Time Shifter, and it's really great app. You actually just plug in where you're going to and then where you're leaving from, and it'll give you a protocol for when to get light exposure and when to take melatonin and how to shift your schedule before you go. And that can really help to minimize the jet lag.
This is very helpful too. Perfect. And is blue light really so bad?
Blue light is one of these things that it's really taken hold in popular culture, right? That blue light is bad for sleep. But actually, the research on this isn't as robust as we might think it is. And in fact, blue light exposure has been shown to have a little bit of an impact on sleep, but not as much as everyone says online. So there were several studies showing that the impact maybe delays sleep by about like 3 to 4 minutes. So it's not like this huge impact. However, having said all of that, this doesn't mean that people should be on their screens getting blue light exposure in the evening, because there's other factors that come into play. So these factors include, what are you doing in the evening? So are you scrolling your phone? Are you on social media? Are you doing email in the evening on your phone? Those things are going to have an impact, right? So looking at how those behaviors might be affecting you. TV actually isn't as bad. So patients will often ask me, but I like to fall asleep to a TV show, or just helps me unwind to watch a movie in the evening or watch my show, but I know I'm not supposed to use screens an hour before bedtime. And then what happens is that can start to create more anxiety. So what I tell patients is that if it is relaxing to you to watch TV, if there's a show that you like to watch, it's not going to keep you up. So it's not the time to watch true crime dramas or anything. But if there's a show that you enjoy and it's relaxing, then it's okay to watch that. You can dim the brightness on your screen just so it's less stimulating to your brain. And then dim your ambient light as well. So whatever room you're sitting in, if you're in your living room, bedroom, keep the lights down. So I recommend to people after about 7 p.m., start dimming the lights and don't use overhead lights. You can use a table lamp or floor lamp. And again, keep those to a minimum. You can even consider putting in dimmer switches or using orange or red bulbs in your lighting. So all of these things are supportive. So blue light, maybe, but there's so many other aspects that go into this.
I see. How about watching your favorite comedy or some relaxing show just on your phone or iPad in bed in a dark room? Is it bad? Like, is it very bad or slightly bad, or is it still okay?
Yeah, definitely. So it really depends. Like, I think there's a few of us sleep doctors who are like, you know what? If you want to watch your show on your iPad in bed, go for it. I don't think you hear that from a lot of sleep doctors often, but I know there's a few of us who fall into this camp where there's actually been studies more in kids, teenagers, showing that it reduces insomnia when they engage in those types of behaviors. Because imagine if you're lying there and you're anxious and you're thinking about all the things you have to do or all the worries that you have, and you're lying in this dark room with no stimulation, and that's where your mind goes. That's not helpful for sleep. So if you're watching a show and it gets your mind off of those things and it's relaxing and calming your nervous system and it's not too bright, then I'd say go for it. And we don't want to have too much rigidity around it. One tip that I recommend to people is if you're watching it on your phone or your iPad, just put it face down. And just like, if you have a partner with you, you can use your phones on so you don't disturb them. But if you're alone, you can just have it face down and you can just listen to it. And then you might fall asleep that way, and see if you can put a timer. So if you do fall asleep to that show or whatnot, have a timer so that you're not awoken later on by the noise, so that it shuts off by itself.
This is very helpful. What other tips or some helpful ideas would you recommend for sleeping better and for helping patients to sleep better?
Sure. So general tips for most people, one is to really focus on circadian rhythm. So what that means is having a regular routine as much as possible. I know for shift workers and things, it's not always possible, but as much as you can, regular routines, light exposure in the morning, darkness exposure in the evening, regular mealtimes, physical activity. Those simple things really do have a big impact. The second thing, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. So it's making sleep a priority, doing things that are supportive to it. And what I just recommend to people is asking yourself, is what I'm doing a sleep supporter or a sleep disruptor? And just starting to identify, noticing how things affect you. Everyone's different. Everyone responds to different behaviors in different ways. So just noticing what works for you, making sleep a priority. And then the third tip is, if you're doing all of these things, but it's not working and you're really not sleeping well, then don't wait to talk to somebody, right? You can talk to a sleep physician or a sleep psychologist to see what might be going on, because sleep issues are highly treatable and you don't have to live with bad quality sleep.
This is important, yes. And in last episode, you mentioned about food and sleep. If you could elaborate a little more about food.
Yes, absolutely. So when I think about food and sleep, first thing I think about is the timing of meals, right? And again, this is so individual, because I have patients where they can't go to sleep hungry, or they're awoken at night by drops in blood sugar. So for people who struggle with that, then having a high fiber snack about an hour before bed can be really helpful, so that they're not waking up in the middle of the night and then they're grabbing a bag of chips or something in the pantry, or a bar of chocolate or something like that. So having a high fiber snack about an hour before bed can be helpful for some people. So this might include things like vegetables and hummus or some fruit with nut butter, something like this. On the other hand, there are people who sleep much better when they have a fasting window before they go to bed. And so I have people that told me that if I stop eating at X time, maybe 5 hours before I go to bed, I sleep way better. So there's no one size fits all approach here. The first step is really to tune into your body and notice how different timing of meals and food affects you. Then noticing how specific types of food affect you. So we talked a bit about fiber. We talked about sugar in the last episode. There are studies showing that higher fiber, lower sugar diets induce better quality sleep, deeper sleep. So noticing that. Also just paying attention, of course, to caffeine, to alcohol. Those are sleep disruptors. And then really noticing gut health. So for example, some more subtle things that might fall into this category are food sensitivities. So people might have food sensitivities to things like gluten, dairy, soy. Those are common ones, eggs. People can have food sensitivities to all kinds of things, strawberries, carrots, all kinds of foods. So just noticing if there's certain things that tend to be a little bit more disruptive or irritating to your system. And sometimes working with someone who has expertise in that area can be helpful because this can be a little bit more subtle and harder to pinpoint in some cases.
How about spicy food? Is it okay before sleep or should there be some window?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So the general rule of thumb is to finish heavy meals about 3 hours before bed. And I would put a similar guideline around spicy food because that can exacerbate reflux. So for people who are eating spicy food or eating heavy meals right before bed, they can have more episodes of reflux and that can also impact sleep. And also your body is going to either digest your food or focus on sleep, right? I mean, it's not that simple, obviously, but like, so you have to give your body time to process and to digest things. Again, generally, notice how things make you feel and just start to pay attention. Your body will tell you what you need to do.
Oh, yes. And if you can tell again about your program for our listeners who didn't have the chance to listen to previous episode yet, how they can connect with you.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. So people can find me on YouTube at IntraBalance, I-N-T-R-A Balance. And I have a YouTube channel teaching physicians and therapists about integrative sleep medicine. And then I also have a program called the Clinical Sleep Kit. It's a membership program where we have a great community and lots of lessons and training and guest experts all about sleep. And then I have a private practice that's called Pacific Integrative Psychiatry. And you can find that at pacificintegrativepsych.com.
Thank you so much for coming and for sharing your knowledge so generously. Such helpful information for any physician and for any person who likes to have a great sleep. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to my podcast. If you enjoyed it or found it helpful, please subscribe, leave a 5-star review, and share it with a friend. Have any topics you'd like covered? Send me an email at joyfulsuccessliving@gmail.com. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram to connect at Joyful Success Living. Have an amazing week. See you next time. The Voices of Women Physicians podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not provide any medical, financial, tax, legal, or psychological services or advice. You are responsible for your own well-being, decisions, and results. Dr. Resnick is a practicing physician, but Voices of Women Physicians podcast is not reflective of the opinion of her employer. You should always contact a professional if you have any specific questions about your unique situation.